So today I want to talk about a koan that I'm unable to find. It's called Linji or Rinzai's Person of No Rank. somehow the marker fell out of the book, and as I look through the book, I'm not finding it. So it's a little like a dream. Have you ever had a dream where you go to work and you look down and you realize you don't have any pants? Or you have a dream where you have to give a lecture? This is the English professors. You get up in front of the class and you realize you don't have your lecture notes and you don't know what you're supposed to lecture on. So it's a little bit like that today. The koan is Linji's Person of No Rank. So you could say, Linji says that there is a person of no rank who goes in and out through the door of your face and asks if you've met that person. So that's the koan for today. Linji's Person of No Rank. Person of No Rank. So, this kind of Zen that we do, the school of Zen that we practice in, is called Rinzai Zen, Linji Zen, Linji Zen. And a particular style of practice has been passed on from teacher to student since the time of the great Tang Dynasty master, Linji, or Japanese people say Rinzai. And one of Rinzai's teachings was the teaching of the person of no rank. He said, inside yourself, there is a person of no rank who goes in and out through the gates of your face. Now, what could that possibly mean? Linji, Rinzai, definitely wants us to meet that person. So, you know, this koan is about the self, you know, the self, yourself. In our world, it's very important to be a self or to have a self. When you're a little kid, you begin to identify with the people around you. And you begin to understand yourself through their eyes. Yeah. So, as you're growing up, you don't really have an identity. You really don't. You begin to acquire an identity in response to the people around you. And this can happen even when people are very, very little. There was a psychiatrist, a child psychiatrist, who actually set up a lab where he would photograph babies responding to their mothers. And he noticed how carefully babies looked at the eyes of their mothers. And babies were especially attentive for the moments when the mother would look at them. And these films, pieces of which I have actually seen, are fascinating, because when the mother looks at something and her face brightens because she's interested, the baby looks at the same thing. And the baby learns, I should be interested in this, and I should be excited by this. So the baby sort of learns what to look at by watching the mother watch the world, you know. And when the mother's eyes alight on the baby responds very powerfully. It's very moving to see the baby in the seeing itself being seen by the mother and responding very energetically with a lot of joy and love. So, you know, this relationship between a baby and its mother is really incredibly important. And it's also interesting to see that when the mother looks away and the baby is looking for the mother's eyes and it doesn't find the mother's eyes, the baby has kind of like some emotional distress, right? It's a little hard for the baby to manage not being seen by the mother when it wants to be seen. And when the mother's eyes return to the baby's face brightens up and so on. So very young, you know, we learn to see ourselves through the eyes of other people. And when we're growing up, you know, we learn to define ourselves or see ourselves the way other people see us, right? Maybe this seems obvious, but this is a very powerful dynamic. My sister was very outgoing and athletic person. And I think sometimes people in the community sent my sister a signal that she wasn't behaving the right way for a girl, you know. My sister was a very outgoing and physical person, very athletic. And I think sometimes she had her hurt feelings because she wasn't responding to other people in a way a girl is supposed to respond. So she sort of felt hurt or rejected or ungirlish, you know. And we all go through this, you know. As we're growing up, we learn to be like, you learn to want certain things because your parents want you to want them, or to be certain things because your parents want you to be them. And you look for the approval in their eyes and you try to win their attention and their approval. And they try to mold you, obviously. Your parents love you and they want you to be a certain kind of person. You know, I was reading a book about child literacy. And it would say one of the best ways to get children interested in books is to model reading for your children. So you can read to the children. But also, if the child sees you reading, you know, sometimes a child will also want to participate in what you're doing, you know. So the child learns that probably if you're reading, it's something you approve of, and then the child will try to read too, even if it just means holding the book in her hands and maybe holding it upside down. She's looking for your approval, right? She's looking for your approval by doing what she knows you value, right? So this dynamic is really very important. As we're growing up, we learn to be a self, you know. In some cultures, people don't get a name at the time of their birth. Isn't that interesting? There are actually some cultures where people are given a provisional name until it's pretty certain that you're going to survive, actually. And then you're given your real name. But in some cultures, there's a delay in naming you. And sometimes in cultures, you're named multiple times at different places in your life trajectory, you know. But when you're a little child, you know, you're given a name like Bill, or you're given a name like Susan, and that's assigning you to like a gender, and to a role, you know. Names go with all kinds of baggage, you know. So if you give your child the name Theodore, you know, that's a different name from, say, Ted, you know. That means different things. If you call your child Ted, that means one thing. If you call your child Theodore, you're sending a different signal to your child. You know, years ago, I met a person in my department who I'd never had much contact with. His first name was Daniel. And I had met him on social occasions, but I never had a chance to really sit and talk with him. And we had a cup of coffee together, and I called him Dan. I said, "Hey, well, Dan, what do you think?" And I looked over, and he was like very bothered by this. And he leaned over to me, and he said, "My friends call me Daniel." You know, I was like, "Whoa, okay, I'm sorry." And I said, "Please forgive me. I didn't understand." You know. So there was something going on there, right? I mean, his identity, he's not a Dan, he's a Daniel, you know. You know, we all go through this. So as we're growing up, you know, you look to your mother for approval, for recognition, and for love and affection. And as we're growing up, we want to duplicate that experience. So we tend to, you know, often when we're little, we tend to do what we'll get that loving and affectionate response from our parents. It makes perfect sense, right? And so, you know, if you're given a parent might say to you, "What do you want? I believe in gender equality. Susan, come here. What do you want? Do you want to play with this soldier or do you want to play with this doll?" Now, you know, it might or might not be a real choice. You know, you might be able to sense that maybe your parents want you to choose the doll. You know, and if you choose the soldier, they might say, "Are you sure you want the soldier? You know, think again, you know." There's all kinds of, you know, children aren't stupid. They know you pretty well by a certain time. They know what you want them to pick, you know, to some degree. So, you know, we all want to be approved of. We all want to be loved. We all want that loving gaze. And so we tend to pick the doll if that's what we think our parents want, or the soldier if we think that's what our parents want. And we like to be loved. We like to be liked. So, you know, gradually we become Theodore, or we become Ted, or we become Susan, or we become Sue. And we say, "This is who I really am. This is who I really am." You know, that's an interesting claim, though, isn't it? This is who I really am. It's like we learn how to act a part. We're really like a little actor learning how to act a part, and the part is called a boy, or the part is called a girl, and we learn how to play it. We learn how to get good at playing the part. You know, it's like being a skillful actor, I think. We try to be accomplished at playing the part. You know, a lot of life is being skillful at playing the part you've chosen to play or that you've been assigned in life. Some people are really skillful at being a self, at playing the role, right? So, you know, I definitely know people who are like very, very charismatic intellectuals. You know, they're professors. They were born to be professors, right? You know, they just seem deeply fitting for that role. You know, like this is what they were made to do. They're just like professors down to the atoms in their body. But you know, I think it would be more true to say that they're very accomplished at playing that role. They're very skillful at playing that role. And a part of it is that they're committed to being that person. They have all kinds of motives for wanting to be that person. And mostly probably associated with love and approval and so on. You know, and sometimes, though, in life we have to play roles that we can't totally buy into, right? You know, so I've talked about this before, but, you know, my father, when I was a kid, I got very interested in, puppets and a puppet theater. And in Baltimore, when I was growing up, there weren't really lots of puppets at the stores. You know, toy stores were sort of like Mattel toys, you know, so it was Soldier, Barbie, there were no, marionettes, things like that, and I really wanted to have a puppet, but I couldn't find one, so I actually got a doll, a couple of dolls. I got a Ken doll and a Barbie doll, and my father became incredibly terrified by this, right? This was very threatening to him, to his project for who I was supposed to become. And I remember going I lived in an area of Baltimore called on a street called Lock Raven Boulevard, if you know Baltimore. And it was a fairly like middle, in those days people didn't always have houses. It was a nice apartment complex. And I walked over to across the street to the store, and I bought two dolls. And the woman who was ringing up the at the cash register was actually laughing at me, and she said, like, "Marge, come here. This boy wants to buy a doll." And they were all like laughing at me. It was really humiliating, you know. Somehow I got the doll home, and that was when my father just, you know, lost all composure. You know, so anyway, eventually the dolls sort of disappeared. I think my parents, you know, spirited them away. But my father soon after that bought me like a football outfit, right? Like a football outfit. And he said, you know, he gave me this, it was for my birthday or something, and I opened the box, and there was a helmet. You know, this was a Baltimore, so this was the Baltimore Colts. And everybody would watch TV and see the quarterback's name was Johnny Unitas. And he said, "You could be just like Johnny Unitas, you know." A football uniform, right? And I wasn't on a team, you know, so I don't know what I was supposed to do. There was a helmet. My parents didn't have a lot of money, so they spent a fair amount of money on this equipment. It was so, you know, now in retrospect, I can realize my parents were just really frightened that I wasn't going to be a quote-unquote normal kid. And they were trying to entice me, you know, reward me into being the, as my father said, he gave me the football outfit and he said, "You are a red-blooded American boy," right? Meaning, you are not a red-blooded American boy. So, you know, as we grow up, you know, we have to sometimes play roles that we don't want to play or that we're not able to play very skillfully. You know, like my sister is a wonderful person. You know, she is a oncology nurse practitioner. So she works with people all the time who are basically dying of cancer. And she has done that all her life, and she's the most wonderful, wonderful person in the world. You know, when she was a little girl, she struggled with not fitting the sort of like ultra feminine model, right? And she, you know, she is like a physically large person, and she had these interests. You know, she was very athletic. You know, she would have loved to play. She was the one who should have gotten the football uniform. Now that I think about it, really, you know. But I could have had the dolls, and she could have the football uniform. It all would have worked out. But you know, that kind of ambivalence. You know, you have to play this role, but you don't want to play the role, or it doesn't fit. You know, this goes on and on in life, and it's the occasion for a lot of shame and so on. You know, so you know, by the time you're an adult, you can have. You know, this issue of having a self or being a self is really like incredibly important to us, right? And it is true that we need to be able to be a self or have a self in a way that we can live with and that we can be reasonably happy with, right? You know, so people get trapped in roles they don't want to be, people they don't want to be, selves they don't want to occupy. Or they feel they have to be a certain kind of self, but they hate it. Or they feel guilty. Or they're in the role, but they develop, you know, ways of coping that are counterproductive, you know. So, like addiction, right, you know. This issue of, you know, it's very important to be a self or to have a self and find a self that you are comfortable with. You know, so a lot of people have huge amounts of shame, right? Because they feel that they haven't become the exemplary self they should have been, right? And you know, practically everybody who is alive has a fair amount of shame because they didn't become the person they imagined they should become in order to be loved, right? You know. So most people carry around a huge amount of shame. They feel that they haven't been able to become the truly lovable person they wanted to be. You know, and we all have versions of this. I have a good friend whose parents, I've mentioned this before too, his father was a musician and music teacher in Seattle. They're Finnish people. And his father was a personal friend of the great Finnish composer Sibelius. And my friend John, you know, his father wanted him to be like a concert pianist. And John, you know, actually wanted to, he wasn't at all interested in the arts. He likes music, but he didn't want to be a concert pianist. He doesn't particularly like classical music. He wanted to be a doctor of all things, right? You know, that was a joke. Most parents want their children to become doctors. My mother wanted me to be a doctor, and I became an English teacher. But John's parents were dying for him to be a musician, and instead he became a brain, a neuroscientist and brain doctor, basically. So he disappointed his parents. And he was guilty all his life, you know. He's 80 years old now, but for a long time he struggled with all kinds of shame. It's amazing. I went to meet his father, who was like this old European guy, and we went to their house, and it was like a weekend, and I went in and met John's father, and his father's wearing a suit. You know, like in his house, right? It's like a full. He was like this European high culture person, right? So everybody else is walking around in blue jeans, and this man is sitting in his house on the middle of the day in his full suit, right? Smoking nervously, and so John felt deeply ashamed, like he let his parents down, and he had developed some. Bad. He became very, very addicted to smoking. He had a very, very serious smoking problem, and luckily hasn't died of cancer. But he struggled so many times to get rid of his addiction to cigarettes. Anyway, lots of people go through this, right? You know, they're ashamed because they imagined a kind of idealized person they could become, and when they became that person, everyone would love them, right? And, you know, we all have these problems of, finding an identity we can be comfortable with. And we have these conflicts because, you know, one parent says, you know, in one breath, the parent says, oh, no, do what you love. And in the next breath, the parent says, oh, you're going to do that? You know, so do you want the doll or do you want the soldier? And you pick the soldier, and are you sure? Don't you want the doll? So, you know, these conflicts are in there all the time, and they cause us incredible amounts of suffering, right? I had read something the other day. Lots of doctors have twice the normal rates of addiction, twice the normal addiction rate. And doctors are actually quite statistically, they have much higher rate of job dissatisfaction than average person. So doctors actually are not very happy as a group. And it may be, you could speculate, that they were fulfilling some dream of their parents, not what they wanted to be or do, you know. So it's very important to work all of this out. You know, it's important to have a self that you can be comfortable with, and also to be accomplished at being a self, right? You know, being accomplished at being a self. My mother really was an interesting person. You know, she she wanted to be a lawyer at a time when my grandparents didn't really have, during the Great Depression, my grandparents didn't really have the money to send all of their kids to college, so they sent my uncle to college. And they didn't send my mother to college. And I don't know if they would have sent her to college even if they had had the money. You know, they were definitely not into, they weren't feminists, for example, my mother's family. My mother went to work in a law office because she was fascinated by the law. And she really became an excellent, a court reporter. And it was fascinating to her. And then, when she got married after the war, she gave up her whole career and she just stayed at home and took care of her kids. And I think she was very unhappy and felt really unhappy with herself. And I know that when she would go into, she would go to social events where she was with women who were much more accomplished than she was. And I know that she felt great shame and anxiety about those encounters. You know, I, as an adult, I can realize why she was so tense and unhappy about that. You know, so there's lots of problems being a self. And there are lots of contradictions in being a self, you know. So we spend a long time working them out, and things don't always work out well. We develop a very destructive habit sometime. You know, right now we're watching two people who are running for president, both of whom are in some ways, rather like all human beings, really rather wounded human beings. You know, I think Donald Trump is really like probably a sociopath, and he's an incredible narcissist. We don't know how that happened, but he's not a normal person, right? He doesn't seem to have any powers of empathy or compassion, right? He seems incredibly self-absorbed, and we don't know how that happened. But something went terribly wrong. And that's all, you know, to a much lesser degree, I think that's true of Hillary Clinton, too. You know, I myself am not a big fan of hers, but I keep thinking about, if you think about it, she was married to a very charismatic serial philanderer who cheated on her again and again, which is so humiliating, right? And, you know, would undermine most people's self-esteem, you know. So the fact that she's been able to be so accomplished in spite of this horrible marriage, really, to this person who has betrayed her again and again, you know, that's very complicated. So, you know, when people say that she's very icy or very steely, you know, you can, if you think about the story she brings, it explains a lot, right? I mean, the fact that she's able to, she hasn't been destroyed by being undermined by this person is pretty amazing. So, anyway, Linji says, inside of you, however, there is a person of no rank. You know, no rank. And I think this is tremendously important. You know, we become so caught up in being a self and having a self that, you know, we forget that the self we create or the self we occupy is a kind of role we play. That it in a certain way, it's not real. It's not real. And in a certain way, it's not who we really are. It's not. You know, that by the time we're, 25 years old or 30 years old, it's very difficult to remember the time when we weren't Kurt or Susan. You know, but there was such a time. You know, it's very important to develop a self you can live with and be happy with. And if you can do that, you'll have a much better life. But if you just, Linji's point is, if you just live in yourself, you know, you're not living fully. or as happily as you could live. You know, we get so caught up in the drama of having a self and being a self that we forget that our essential nature is not this self. It's like, you know, if you take off the mask and the costume, there's something else there. And Rinzai calls this something else the person of no rank. See, the person of no rank. You know, Rinzai lived in a time, the Tang Dynasty, when a society was becoming more and more stratified. And so everybody in Chinese society had a rank, everybody, you know. My father worked for the government. And in the government, everybody in the government has a rank, everybody, not just military people, but civilians too. So it's called a GS rating. So there are people who are like GS 25. They are like incredibly high up. And there are people who are like GS 4s, right, who are like at the bottom of the ladder. So, you know, if you have a certain mindset, when you walk into a government building, you're immediately noticing, oh, he's a 4, he's a 10, he's a 12, he's a 15, right? And my father was that kind of person. You know, he was very, very sensitive to his rank. And he would hang out with people who were like 16s when he was a 14, and he would feel a little bit ashamed of himself. You know, of course, it's insane to do this, right? To say, oh, he's a 16 and I'm merely a 14. How unworthy I am. But the system wants you to think like that, right? So you know, Linji grew up in a society that was like that. Everybody had a rank. In fact, many government officials had insignias. So like the emperor could wear yellow and have a dragon, and nobody else could wear yellow and have that dragon. And each rank had an emblem that marked them out, and that was their status. That was where they were in the world. So, you know, you're not a dragon, you're a who knows what, you know. But the thing is, you know, this is totally artificial, right? It's totally unreal. It's a collective fantasy. And it's usually designed to keep people in their place and to make people docile and obedient, right? And it does it mostly by making people very unhappy. Yes, making people mostly unhappy about themselves, right? So you know, not everything about our culture is a good thing. You know, we sort ourselves out into people who are, quote, successes and our failures, you know, who are high up and who are low down. All of these things operate in our consciousness all the time. And, you know, I do think many, many people feel ashamed. I think shame is a normal part of modern life, because we're told, when we're little kids, we're told, you could be the president, right? I mean, my grandmother said that to me. She said, you could be the president of the United States. She also told me I could do anything I wanted, and I asked her, can I walk through a wall? And she told me, don't be fresh. But I believed her. I thought, really? I had seen Superman on TV. I wasn't being fresh, I swear. I really believed her. I thought, how can that be possible? But look, you know, my grandmother said, you can be president. I haven't turned out to be president. So I'm a washout, right? Yes, we laugh, but we think this way, right? You know, we think this way. You know, the average, they've done studies, the average American, honestly, the average like 25-year-old American believes he has a good shot at becoming a multimillionaire. You can Google it. You know, he has no shot, statistically, no shot. But, you know, 50 years later, that person sits in shame and says, I could have been a contender. I could have been a contender and I'm not. You know, it's my fault. So, you know, Rinzai is saying something, Linji is saying something incredibly important. That you are not your name. You are not the role you play socially. These are part of who you are. Yes, that's true. You know, I get a check every 2 weeks that has my name and I pick it up. And I would be mad if somebody else got it instead. But that is not who I really am. You know, I have another. Another self. I have the person of no rank that I enter into when I sit on the cushion. And that person has no birthday, and you know, no age, and it has no rank. It's not president. It's not anything in the human world, right? And it lives in connection to everything around us, you know. That is your true nature. It's like the universe is your true nature. The universe is who you really are. That's what Linji is saying, and that's what Zazen is trying to teach people. You know, we get so down about not being president or not being this, you know, the thing we thought would make us lovable, that we don't participate fully in our own existence. And our own existence is much bigger than the self we occupy. And Zen is about living this bigger life, you know, the bigger life. The person of rank is a little tiny part of something much bigger. Your true nature is the universe itself, at play. You know, the universe doesn't have a rank. It doesn't have a purpose. It doesn't get a paycheck. It isn't judged, right? It's much bigger than those human standards of measurement. You know. And so we live in a little box called the self, and we agonize about it all the time. And it is important to work out our inner contradictions. It is important to be a self, that find a self you're comfortable with. That's very important. But it's not all we are. We're something bigger than that. And that's what Linji is talking about. That's the person of no rank who goes in and out of the doors of your face. And he says, have you met the person of no rank? And if you meet that person, your life is completely transformed. You know, I have been doing Zazen for 40 years, and you might wonder, what does he do on that cushion? You know, it's the same every time. I sit down on the cushion, you know, what the heck is going on in there? I am being present with my true nature, the person of no rank. And I feel connected to everything around me. And when I leave this room and go outside, same thing. You know, it's so refreshing to not be curt. And I'm not denying the importance of being Kurt or Susan or Bill. You have to get your act together. You know, in life you have to pay your rent. You know, you have to pay your mortgage. You have to have a car if you need a car. You have to put gas in your tank. You can't run out of gas on the turnpike or you're really in trouble. So you have to have your act together. It's true. If you take pride in your work, that's good. That's all good. But if you just live in yourself, you're living in a very small world. There's something bigger here than Kurt or Susan or Ted or Theodore. And it's Buddha nature. We say Buddha nature. And it's who we really are. We're Buddhas pretending to be Kurt, pretending to be Susan, right? And you can't just say, oh, great, problem solved, right? You know, you have a lot of conditioning that you have to work through. So this is, you could think about meditation as sort of working through all these layers. It's like taking off the makeup, taking off the costume, you know, putting the critical reviews in the drawer of your last performance, you know, the drama critic who said good performance or bad performance, put it in the drawer, take off your makeup. You know, so a lot of zazen is just taking off the makeup, taking off the and sometimes we don't want to take the makeup off, you know. We're attached to our suffering even. You know, but little by little we take off the costume, we take off the makeup, and we become the universe. And so it's something you learn how to do, and it takes a lot of practice. You've spent, if you're 25 years old, you've spent 22 of those years, or 23 of those years, pretending to be who you are, you think you are. You know, and so it takes a little practice to get out of that habit. But when you do your zazen, and you sit down on the cushion, you become the person of no rank. And you are really free. You are really free. You know, you're in a bigger world. This, you know, and let's face it, you know, humans may or may not exist 1,000 years from now, right? You know, some guy from another planet might land on this planet and he'd find, you know, he'll find, you know, paycheck stubs or something. And he'll say, some people lived in little shacks and other people lived in these enormous, lived in little shacks and were constantly terrified that they wouldn't have a next meal. Whereas these other people, they had so much money, they had 3 swimming pools in the back. You know, what was wrong with these humans? You know, no wonder they went extinct, right? So you know, we are a very troubled species, one could say, right? And we may or may not work out our problems. But, you know, we are not just Kurt, Susan, we are not just human. You know, we have a self which is the self of the universe. It participates in all being. It has no age, it has no birth date, and no place of birth. You know, so you know, you can live your life in your small box, and you can, or you could come and sit from time to time and have a little taste of your true self, or you can make this part of your life. Eventually, there's like a shift in how you live. You know, most of us spend all of our time in the little self, and occasionally we stumble. You know, we go to the Grand Canyon and go, "Oh my God, that's amazing." And for 20 minutes, we feel like we've been out of ourselves, right? Or you go to the museum, or you hear an opera, you know, and then you come back, and then you're back in the box. But, you know, you don't have to live like that. You could spend a lot of your life in your bigger self, and relatively less of your life in your smaller self. And that would be a good thing from the standpoint of Zen. You know, from the standpoint of Zen, it's rather a shame that people don't appreciate who they really are, you know. I once heard somebody say, you know, the human being is like it's like an iPhone that's used as a doorstop, right? So many apps not used, right? So that's certainly true from the Zen standpoint. Human beings are Buddhas who go through their whole life worried about whether their nose is too long, you know. Yes, isn't that? That's really sad. Or that they don't make enough, right? You know, I have friends, you know, who make a lot of money, you know, and, you know, if they don't get another raise, they feel they can't sleep. It's like, why are you worried, you know? You have everything you could ask for, you know? You need another house, you know? So it's definitely the case that we make ourselves miserable, right? We're Buddhas who don't have to be miserable. We could be really happy. We could be really Buddhas. So, thank you so much for coming today and encountering the person of no rank. And I hope you make that person your best friend.